Speaking of this thing. Any rate, then at that point, we'll kind of move on to another topic. But the very first topic that we'd like to discuss is this issue of infinite niche packing, continuous sort of species. And what I'm going to at least kind of throw out there, first off, is it's very much a real theoretical phenomenon that we can see in these mathematical models in the abstraction. But also more interesting is, can we expect there's any place we'll see them in nature? But to kind of kick off the discussion, I'm going to use our two colleagues here that gave us such wonderful presentations. And Simone, what I'm going to ask you to do is just take like a minute or two, tell us what you think is a done deal on this topic, and then tell us what you think is hot and what's wrong with what, you know, Giorgio is doing on this bigger topic, and then we'll let people kind of jump in.
Yeah. Well, I think...
Could you speak to us? Yeah. Just yeah. That
sure.
Well, in my opinion, this idea of continuous niche packing, well, kind of everybody believes that there is no such thing as a continuous niche packing. Like, you know, in the end, what we see is a discrete set of species. And, well, this thing gave a lot of work to do to a lot of people, including me and Geza, and, you know, because there are so many ways to destroy continuous coexistence. To me, what's interesting is not a way to save continuous niche packing, but whether we understood all the possible way to destroy this scenario, and especially what this different way of destroying niche packing lead to. I mean, which kind of pattern in this trade space are generated, if they are regular, if they are stochastic. I mean, what's really the correct ways to destroy these simple solutions. So for me, this is the interesting question in this moment. So in my talk, I pointed out three possible ways. I don't know if that exhausts all the possibilities or if there are more. I mean, that's my question, I think.
Can you just really quickly review with us those three ways?
Yeah. These three ways is one, to consider heterogeneity, so like other traits, which means that species, even if they have the same trait, they are different for some other reason. Maybe they have a slightly different growth rate and so on. The second is what Geza studied, so have a sharply varying carrying capacity. So like carrying capacity only depends on the trait, but it's like, you know, it's like a box function or a random function and so on. And the last one is what I mostly explored, that is a non-positive defined competition function, like very nonlinear competition function. These are the ways that I know to destroy continuous coexistence, and to me they are different concretely in the sense that they generate different patterns. I don't know if those are all the possibilities that there are. There are more.
Cool. So you're tell us what you think.
Okay.
So yeah, I had a couple of very nice discussions yesterday and today, and I think I understand things much better already than just a few hours ago. So to summarize the... Is it Jules? So to summarize the state of things, there are two issues. So we are talking about the Lotka-Volterra model, which can be thought of as a linearization of any other niche model around an equilibrium point. And first of all, there's a division into two classes, dynamical stability and structural stability. As for the dynamical stability, we know that a necessary condition for the dynamical stability of the model is the competition kernel to be positive definite, which is equivalent to having a positive Fourier transform, which doesn't get negative at any one point. So if that condition is not met, we have no chance of producing continuous coexistence in the first place. So let's not even talk about those cases, and let's assume, in the end I will return for a moment to that case, but for now let's assume that the kernel is positive definite. Its Fourier transform is all positive, therefore continuous coexistence solutions exist in the first place. Now we can turn to the issue of structural stability. That is, if instead of perturbing the densities, we perturb model parameters, what happens. And again, there are two scenarios here, because we can perturb either the R0 function, the density-independent part of the equation, or we can perturb the kernel. As Ulf pointed it out yesterday, if we perturb the kernel, if the Fourier transform is positive, but we expect it to decay asymptotically to zero, therefore, for very low and very high frequencies, the Fourier components will be very close to zero, so it will be very, very simple. An arbitrary small perturbation will be able to bring those very small components down into the negative. And therefore, we're back to the situation where the kernel is not positive definite, therefore we do not have any continuous coexistence. So, in other words, the situation with where we perturb the kernel is structurally unstable. The only exception to this would be if the kernel would be a Dirac delta peak. The Fourier transform of the Dirac delta is a constant, that is, it's bounded away from zero, so a small perturbation can bring it down. However, a Dirac delta peak as the competition kernel simply means that the species do not interact in the first place, so it's not interesting for our case. So in other words, if the kernel is perturbed, the problem is structurally unstable, we're back to the limiting similarity case. Now let's talk about the perturbation of the R0. And this is the somewhat more complicated issue. If the kernel is analytic, then Giza has proven a very nice theorem that the problem is structurally unstable. An arbitrarily small perturbation of the R0 function will bring us back to the limiting similarity case. If the kernel is smooth, that is differentiable at least once, but not analytic, then there's unfortunately no such nice theorem. However, based on numerical simulations, we can be quite sure that it's exactly the same as with the analytic kernels. This is kind of work in progress and would require rigorous proof, though, so just having thrown out something. And the last scenario is when the kernel is kinky. When the kernel is kinky, we have seen that we can get robust continuous coexistence. However, we agreed that a kinky kernel is not realistic in the first place. So we went through our list, and what we have seen is that in every case we recover limiting similarity. There is no realistic scenario where what we get is robust tight packing, robust continuous coexistence. There's a very last case, which I didn't mention, when the Fourier transform is not positive definite, but the kernel is kinky. What happens then? And our conjecture, and again, this would require somewhat of a proof. Maybe Simone can help with that. Is that you will? That's what you get in Scheffer and Van Ness's model. That you get these stable lumps, then an exclusion zone, then another stable lump, then another exclusion zone, etc., etc. So arbitrary similar species do coexist, but not everywhere on the domain of coexistence. So in my view, we've basically done it all, or there are these problems I have thrown out which need some proofs, but assuming that those can be done, we've basically completed the demonstration. We never expect robust continuous coexistence ever.
Very fine. That's awesome. You know,
does anybody have any immediate comments, observations, thoughts on that? Okay, we're going to start back there. We're going to go to Gaze. He's got lots of stuff over there in the corner. Thanks. I just want to speak from where you are.
Yeah, I think that's a very nice mathematical analysis, but so the mathematical part is nice, but it's also its main problem, I think. Because it's very mathematical, it seems to me that, I mean, for all practical purposes, the what's important is, you know, whether it's discrete and, you know, small, or whether it's discrete and very large. Because if it's very large, we won't be able to distinguish that from continuous anyway in real data. So the question is, can we do more than that than just look at either it's continuous or not continuous coexistence?
Cool. I'll let you guys respond sort of later on things. What I want to do is let people kind of get comments. Keep filing them away, Simone and Yuri. We will give you a chance to respond and whatnot. We've got all sorts of gays and queens.
But I would like to say that these things can be very technical about Fourier transforms and so on. And let me say something simple. Having two species instead of infinitely many, And then what is the condition of coexistence? Of course, if they happen to have the same growth rate, they will coexist. But it is if the question is if I give an advantage of or disadvantage of one of them, but not the other, what will happen? Of course, the species which get the advantage will outcompete the other one, except they have a decreased competition between them. And this is the robustness of coexistence of two species, and the issue is what will happen if I give an advantage of one of them, but not the other. Now, if we have more than two, we can do the same, and if we have a continuum of them, we can do the same. And the question is whether, of course, in any model, I can figure out carefully the R-node function, which just adjusts all strategies has the same fitness. I can do any time, and I will get the continuous coexistence. But if I start to give advantage of and disadvantage of very similar species, between them the competition is still strong, then the more advantages will outcompete the less advantages, and this continuous coexistence will be lost. And this is the what people like me consider formally and prove theorem, but the essential issue is that continuous coexistence can be destroyed by perturbation if the perturbation is such that it gives advantage and disadvantage to very similar strategies. And this is the intuitive question why continuous coexistence in the real world is not really expected. And answering your question, actually, well, of course, it's meaningless to decide in practice whether it is really continuous or very dense, but if it is more dense than the scale of the competition, then probably there is a perturbation which will destroy this coexistence.
Bob? I've got three just general comments. One thing, I think, you know, if you go back to when limiting similarity came about, it was MacArthur and Levin's 1967 and papers right around that time. And Levin and MacArthur in his Geographical Ecology had a very nice kind of pictorial representation on why you care. You know, why do you care about limiting similarity? And it went as follows. You imagine that you have a certain volume of research, of resources available to you. You may think about a line, for instance. And then you say, species have a certain degree of specialization along that line. How many species do you have? I mean, if you're interested in what determines how many species there are, what do you need to know? You need to know how much resources available, how specialized the average species is, and how closely you could pack two species, how much they could overlap. And so if you have a limiting similarity, i.e. how close you can be for a given web, then for a given, you know, amount of resource, you have a rule that gives you what the species diversity ought to be, what the richness ought to be. So a question you can ask about any model that seems to have limiting similarity is just how limiting is it? I mean, what does it tell you about how constrained diversity is given that sort of view of the world? So that's sort of something, you know, so that to me is a more interesting question than whether or not you get a continuum or limiting similarity, because limiting similarity, if it's really tiny, you can have a jillion species coexist, you know, in your resource space. So what? You know, for all practical purposes, it doesn't matter. And there is one circumstance we've already talked about today where you can pack a huge number of species into a continuum, and the continuum is a continuum in space where each locality is separated from the other localities and you don't have movement back and forth, i.e. you don't have competition from one piece of the gradient to the next piece of the gradient. So if you go to the tropics, to the poles, to first approximation, at the scale at which individuals you know, there's a huge number of communities that are packed in there. So you could have as many species as you like, almost, packed into that. I had a third point. What was it? Okay, the third point is, you know, if you think about, so not the Lockerville Terra model, but an explicit resource consumer model. So we've got one resource and two consumers. So we've got the R-star rule that whichever species can persist the lowest resource level wins out. Fine. There's a lot of evidence for that. But we also know that you when it can break down. When it can break down is when you have direct density-dependent interference within each species that's sufficiently strong. And in fact, you know, mathematically, you can get as many consumers as you like coexisting on a single fungible resource as long as the intra-specific interference competition is strong enough. And, you know, maybe that's not a very, maybe it's not a robust coexistence. I don't know. But to me, you know, so then you can say, well, how many can, you know, what are the mechanisms that lead to that kind of interference and how many species could coexist? And once again, if you're up to 100 or 200 that can coexist in one resource, that's not that, you know, for all practical purposes, it may as well be an infinite number, okay?
So those are my thoughts.
Anybody else want to comment? Mr. Sickler, where we got to get some comments from you. You have to have some comments, because you're the one that has these communities that, at least to somebody who works with three species of squirrels, seems infinite. And then you have lakes that don't have so many, so you have to say something.
Yeah, right. I just wonder at this point in the discussion whether, so seeing all the your very strong arguments about the instability of a continuum, and I'm also not thinking that the cichlids are necessarily an exact continuum, but I'm wondering whether these disturbances and instabilities that make the continuum unstable, at what time scales, if we think of evolution, what time scales would this happen? Like, would it be possible that there are systems where speciation, in a way, outpaces the frequency of these instabilities to destroy a continuum?
Actually, I'm going to let them go ahead and quick respond to that, and then I'd like to get other people's comments. That one was definitely a question to you guys. So, yeah, that.
Yeah. So far, I talk mostly about models, but you know, if one thinks about reality and you know, what one should incorporate in models to go beyond what we know. I think there are two aspects which has been not so much studied. One is what he just mentioned, I mean, the dynamical aspect. So you can have exclusion, but how long does it take to have exclusion? And for this aspect, I think the most important thing is to figure out what is the magnitude of the fitness differences. I mean, like the growth rate of species, how different can it be? Is 1%, 1 per 1,000? And the inverse of this number is roughly the number of generation it takes to have exclusion. So if this number is very long, then limiting similarity is just a mathematical game. It's not something which is relevant for realistic situation. And the second aspect, I think, is stochasticity. I mean, the noise, the fact that one has random mutation, one has variability within a species. I mean, all these aspects can influence what happens in models. And one example which I think is... people didn't think so much about in this context is bacteria. I mean, I would say that bacteria basically don't have a limiting similarity. You can find lots of species with any kind of genotypic and phenotypic variation between them. So that could be a case in which, you know, in practice, you don't have a limiting similarity situation.
Yeah. So first of all, I'm sorry. Oh, so, okay. So, stand up. Oh, I'm sorry. Okay. So, I think Rampal's question was pretty well explained by Geza, but what I would want to emphasize is that the assumption of continuous coexistence is really just an approximation to the state that we call tight packing, where there are lots of species put in, not necessarily continuously. If I put in too many peaks, even that requires fine-tuning, and if I perturb the parameters away, some of those peaks will go extinct. So Maybe this continuum thing was overemphasized because that's what's easy to work with analytically. But I think the principle itself certainly applies, even if you don't have a continuum of species coexisting, just very many packed in. And what's many, as Geza said, that depends on the characteristic scale of the problem, which is determined by the competition width. Bob mentioned the problem of, first of all, the space that we change along a latitudinal gradient, and then we can pack in more and more species. Probably, I would think that if we are to model that kind of thing, we would find out that the competition kernel or the analogous thing is actually kinky in that case. That is, local competition is stronger than competition across. We could actually think about that, whether that's an actual instance of kinkiness or not. I would be interested to look through that. And as for the other problem, that on one resource, an arbitrarily many species can coexist as long as they inhibit themselves more than all the others, well, probably, again, if that is to be achieved, you need the competition function, the competition kernel, to have a kink in it, to affect yourself much more than all the others. And I would be happy to discuss that as well, but as far as I understand, that would be very difficult to achieve. And my feeling is, yes.
So imagine you have a plant with herbivorous insects on it.
No.
Hell no. Oh, okay. You can't. Does this work? No, let me put this down. So what I was imagining was, so you imagine with a discrete resource, so think of a plant, think of two herbivorous insects, and then each one has a pathogen. There's a specialist pathogen, okay? And the pathogen's very effective, so it keeps its resource numbers low. I can pack a lot of herbivores onto a single fun resource that way, okay?
Thank you. I would So with this method, you can pack in infinitely many species. However, then in a way, you assume diversity to explain diversity. That is, you need an array of pathogens in the background, and those pathogens are kind of independent regulating entities. And I guess in the regulating factor paradigm, coexistence is explained.
And I'm going to cut you guys off in just a minute.
In plant ecology, that's called the Jansen-Connell effect. That's exactly.
Yeah, okay. So what I'd like to do really quickly, could everybody in here who's an empiricist put up your hand? Anybody who considers themselves an empiricist? Okay, so among those empiricists, those that are willing to comment on this, please keep your hand up. Cool, okay, I just wanted to see, we want to keep a few sort of people, because I think this is important. Andy, please,
I think all the empiricists really do want to comment, but the theoretical details are what's primarily under discussion. And so the truth is that we should really think about the extent to which this happens in nature. And for me, what becomes a really interesting problem is what happens if you don't have continuous resource distributions. You have gaps in those distributions. You have some peaks and some valleys. And my feeling is that that is going to structure the distribution and the number of species along that gradient much more so than is competition. And so if we have time to talk about those general concepts later, that'd be great. But I'm just thinking of, Jürgen's talk, where basically you had 9 niches that were properties of the environment. They weren't properties of the organisms. Whereas a lot of these other talks about adaptive speciation are about organisms changing the environment such as they construct niches which weren't even there to start with. And so those two things, I think, should be reconciled to a greater extent at some point. And when you talk about niche packing and limiting similarity and stuff like that, I think it could all change when you start to think about non-continuous resource distributions.
Cool. Yeah, that makes good sense.
Yeah, thank you. There is one sitting. Well, I can also stand. Okay. Yeah, there is one perspective missing here. That because with all this talking about species, I think we tend to forget that species do not really exist as external realities. So I'm missing this individual-based perspective a little bit. So what we have as the primary entities are individuals, and what we call species are these abstractions that arise only when we identify certain distributions in suitably defined spaces. And now this becomes very complicated because this depends very much on the species, maybe on the family, where you have this trait space more or less worked out by the taxonomist. But already between families and certainly between orders and in between, I'm not so sure, these spaces, these trait spaces are completely different. And there are some consequences of that. First, talking about competition between very different individuals or very different species doesn't make much sense because this concerns these cases where this kernel would drop to zero, basically saying that there is no competition anymore. But these spaces are not comparable anymore in which these entities are defined in the first place. So I guess this doesn't make much sense to talk about this. At least one would have to provide much clearer definitions if you want to tackle this in a mathematical model. The other consequence, I think, concerns what Bob said. Because if you talk about clustering in these trait spaces, then you have to talk about scale. And because clearly the clusters that you can identify depends on your basic idea of how large a cluster there can be. If you take a very large coarse resolution, then you will find much larger clusters than you would find if you take a very fine resolution. And again, this idea of what the right scale is to identify species depends now very much on what taxonomists have agreed about in this certain. So I think it's very difficult to talk about this on an abstract level. And in the end, I find it funny to talk about infinitely many species because naturally there are only finitely many individuals everywhere, from which follows immediately there can only be finitely many species. So even without any clever mechanisms to prevent infinitely many species, I think there can never be infinitely many species in the. I think I'm rambling here. Send me to somebody else.
No, that was excellent. Actually, thanks, because, I mean, this whole discussion then of species and entities, you know, they have it defined very well theoretically, but then, of course, if somebody's practicing this, what is a species? So it was good that came up, so thanks.
Yeah, I sort of have a related point, which is I'm not sure that species really matter ecologically. What does matter is, you know, ecological differences between individuals. So in particular, as far as I know, I think in Lake Victoria, the main radiation is the cichlids, right? Most of the other fish do not radiate. And this is true in Hawaii, for instance. There are, I don't know how many hundreds of species of Hawaiian Drosophila, which do all kinds of very exciting and interesting things. However, there is one nymphalid butterfly, which doesn't seem to have ever got anywhere. And yet, butterflies radiate elsewhere. And it just occurs to me that phylogenetic history could be more important in species diversity than ecological diversification, if you like. And it may be that ecological diversification is a kind of byproduct of sexual diversification or something like that. So it could be that some organisms are better at speciating, and therefore they have to they tend to divide their niches up more readily, whereas other organisms can maintain generalism without trade-offs and occupy a much larger ecological zone. So I don't think that it's very clear that these very detailed ecological models necessarily explain speciation. I do think they explain something, but they're not necessarily species.
Okay, what we're going to do now, because we have other topics to move on to, but what I want to do, so unless there's somebody has a pressing thing, I'm going to let Simone and Yuri have like 40 seconds to give their last comments, and then I have to, because of course he's the dad of it all, let Geza have the last word on this topic, and then we're going to move on.
Please go ahead.
No, go ahead.
I'm sorry. What was the last thing? I forget the last thing you said.
No.
He was wondering, with a finite number of individuals, how could you have individuals?
Oh, yeah. So that leads back to the thing that I said before, that this whole problem is still there if you don't assume a continuous distribution, if you just assume finite number of species. But if they're too close to each other, the same phenomenon happens, that one of them is all too easily driven to extinction. So I want to emphasize again that this continuous assumption is just an abstraction to help analytic reasoning, but it's absolutely not necessary. And if you put the problem on a computer and try it out with a finite number of species, just pack them a little bit too close to each other, what you will see is that this coexistence is extremely fragile. So in that sense, I think that the problem is relevant.
Yeah, I think I have sort of the same comment. Like, I would say that in an individual-based model, you will find exactly the same thing. Of course, since you have discrete individual, you find the one individual, you know, per spot in trait space. But so it's not infinite; it's a finite number. It's the number of individuals you have compatible with the carrying capacity. But you won't have something that macroscopically you call a species. You will have lots of traits and you know, no clear clusters in this trait space, which could be identified as species.
Okay, so I think we're going to give you the last word on this topic. You deserve it. Thanks.
So the original suggestion was by MacArthur and Levins that roughly that many species can coexist as many has space with the Nishvit. How many times they can put the Nishvit? I think that it is still true with two caveats. One of them is that much more species can coexist, provided that if we are very lucky of adjusting the R-naught function. So this is one thing, and the another one that we have to think very, very generally. So if we have apparent competition, for instance, then we should apply this one. And if we have very, very specific apparent competition because of the very, very specific parasites, then it have to count as very narrow niche width. And in this sense, the original suggestion survived.
Well, thank you very much. I really appreciate your allowing yourself to be put on the block and be our sacrificial lambs. Can we give them a round of applause? I thought they were great. Yeah, that was that. So actually, we have two more sacrificial lambs for you. They don't even know they are. And that's going to be Andrew and Jürgen. The topic that we'll be kicking off, so Andrew, keep thinking. I'll kind of drag things out a little bit so you have a chance to kind of think. What I'm going to ask is, we've got sort of the theoreticians versus the empiricists. That's not entirely fair, but I think it is important in terms of that we do have ideas here and we have people that are interested in applying those ideas. And so kind of the general question is going to be, of course, this role of adaptive speciation, evolutionary branching, competitive speciation, whatever that term means. And I want to ask then Andrew to address the question then, or to start off his end of the discussion with, how is this relevant to his work? And as a representative, somebody who works with real species that are evolving, he is the high priest right now among those that hold on to Darwin's finches, our inspiring species here, is, do you think they are actually at any of these convergent stable points hanging out on slopes? And then Jürgen, after he kind of discusses it, I want you to be able to come back to you with the idea, okay, well, what can the empiricists be doing for you? You're offering an exciting model that includes resource utilization within an area, clines, or habitat continuums.
So I'm trying to remember all the things that I'm supposed to comment on now. But I heard one of them was Darwin's finches, so I can comment on that. So I do actually think that I sit and listen to all these talks about adaptive dynamics in particular, and I do think that there is something fundamentally missing that that I see in empirical systems, my own, and I think in many empirical systems. And I've talked with several of you about it already, and it's something I alluded to in my earlier comment. And that is that I think that niches, potential niches, are largely properties of the environment, such that you have a large seed here, and you have a medium seed, and you have a small seed. And those are niches that can be occupied potentially by different species. And I think that the majority of species are driven by the fact that you have these reasonably discrete niches. Think about different plant species on which you have herbivorous insects that occupy them. And I just wonder how much can be explained in reality by these continuous resource distributions and competition on them, where you create fitness minima, things evolve to the fitness minima, and then they diversify, and then they create new fitness minima and new fitness maxima. And I remember watching, I think it was in Joel's talk, where, you know, you had the first species was at 42 units, and then that one evolved to 42 units, and the next two were at, I don't know, what, 34 and 33, and then they kept going, and you had five that were at 18 down to, you know, 12 units. So what happened to 42 units, right? I mean, presumably, I think that the world is structured that you have these environment-provided niches or potential niches that species can occupy. So when I think about Darwin's finches, a lot of people refer to Darwin's finches as, you know, maybe this case where you've packed out the niche space through competition and things like that. And I would never deny that niches, that competition was important in structuring those communities. But what I'm saying is that the positions in that community are determined by environmentally specified potential niches, and that there isn't a continuous distribution between those niches. So things get opportunities to colonize new potential niches, and then they diversify onto those niches. It's not driven fundamentally by competition for shared resources. It contributes, but I don't think it's the primary driver. And so my, I guess if I were to give a challenge to empiricists, I would say, theoreticians, I would say to please try to do more work with the interactions between more complicated resource distributions, temporal variation in those resource distributions, coupled with competition for shared resources. Because I personally think that we will find out ultimately that although these problems on continuous distributions, competition, niche packing, all of this kind of stuff, these are going to be concepts that are interesting theoretically, but perhaps don't explain a lot empirically.
Just real quick, thanks, and follow on, Jim.
Andrew, can you just explain one thing? Does that mean there's a sort of trimodality of seed size in the environment? Is that why there are three species?
At the end of my talk, I suggested that there were two possibilities. One was that competition was driving these different peaks, and the other one is that there is a difference in the underlying resource distribution. I don't have the answer yet. I think both contribute, but my gut feeling, based on that system and other systems, is that there are gaps, and I know there are gaps in the underlying resource distribution. I just can't say for sure that the species are lining up on those for that reason.
And then what I'm hearing then is you're saying that these resource distributions we study in such wonderful Gaussian ways are really lumpy. I'm going to ask you one more thing to throw out there then before letting having Jürgen throwing the opportunity. Jürgen, then, is what I'm hearing then is you would really like to see the modelers here, and you do. You have a fantastic opportunity. You have some of the best in the business sitting out there right now model this. But in terms of as they do their model, do you see your Darwin's finches as primarily sitting on the peaks of an adaptive landscape? Does the concept work for you?
Yes.
I just think those peaks are determined not by competition. Those peaks are determined by underlying resource distributions that are structured independent of the way in which the finches feed on them. They influence it, but they don't structure that. Those peaks. Those peaks are there to start with.
Theoreticians, you heard it here.
Okay. I agree with Andrew that many times we would expect actually discrete resource peaks out there, not perhaps always a continuous resource distribution. Although it remains to be seen then with the seeds of the Galapagos finches whether that is a continuous distribution or not. Well, that there would be some gaps. That's my feeling as well. Still, though, evolution, I think, is still driven by competition, but for those discrete resources then. And what I would like, Joel asked me earlier to somehow ask the empiricist to work for me as well. What would be really, really interesting is if some empiricist at some point would take the concept of a branching point seriously and actually try to find it, observe it in nature or in the lab. For instance, with the Darwin finches, that would be have some exclosure somehow with just one. You would have to show a few different things. First of all, you would have to show convergence to some intermediate finch. So we start with a one single seed specialist with a small beak, say. But in the environment, there will be also larger beaks. So there will be initially, you would have to prove selection for the towards the larger beak. But then you would also have to prove that once you have this intermediate type, then both specialists would be able to invade that system. And I've never seen that in any experiment. It would be really, really neat and nice to see that shown, that would be sort of to nail down the branching point somehow empirically, and that would be really interesting.
Now, I'm sure Andy and Jürgen are going to want to respond to things, but I really want to open up the floor. So Andy and Jürgen, keep listening, because I am going to hand this back to you at some point to do things, but I think I've seen some orders. Did you?
Yeah, and then I'm going to go there. Anyway, we'll get, yeah, so please, that's great.
So responding to Andy, I think that you are right that, of course, the distribution of the food is very important, but there is another factor in the background, and that is the trade-offs for the different species of finches. Of course, they cannot feed on all the seed sizes, and that's what drives the niche pecking, I think, in this case. So that's not only the environment that determines this, but also the guys themselves.
Just a few words. I think that the missing point in all the theoretical approaches is that we're actually missing the physiology of all this process. Like, we would discuss, okay, mass is nice, it looks beautiful, but I mean, physiology, it's much more complicated than it looks like, and the adaptation of the enzymatic adaptation, the expression of different isoforms of enzymes, like, we're just missing it. It's impossible to predict it as like simple as it like it looks like. Same as, for instance, the C4 photosynthesis, like how it evolved, like it's still actually, the evolution is still in process. There are so many species, for instance, Flavaria species, like C3, C4 photosynthesis, and they are at different stages of the C4 evolution. So it's still happening. It's hard to predict all these things like this. It's, I think the missing point is the physiology behind all of this. I don't know.
No, thanks. I think that's actually really cool. We focus on a lot of factors, but there's a lot more to an organism. And then that issue of where are we in the evolutionary process. We got a good organization of people here.
Okay. Coming from the empiric research with very limited mathematical skills, I have a question to Jürgen and all the theoreticians around. And especially, I want to comment about the branching point. And I think there is some missing communication between the evolutionary ecology community and the ecological community, or the niche theory. And I think there are a lot of evidences that show that branching is happening all the time. If you look at the population level or between populations level, I want to promote my own poster that showed different patterns in different populations and the same species that might be explained by a branching continuum, not a branching point. So I think there is a lot of evidence, just need to interpret it in this way.
Okay, yeah. This whole business about niches being out there as opposed to niches being constructed, I think that's a valid point in principle. But I think the way we heard it from Andrew is a bit maybe on the simple side, and I would be remiss if I leave it at that. First of all, we have to recognize that this is a traditional view. Okay, you have these fixed fitness landscapes and species colonize them, and that's a nice and simple picture. And I think in the economy of thought, you don't drop nice and simple pictures before it becomes compelling. I mean, the Ptolemaic system was kept for thousands of years because the evidence was not strong enough to overthrow it, and it worked pretty well. So I also think that this idea of niches being out there is working pretty well. Yeah. So I don't think that you run into everyday trouble with it. But I think, on the other hand, it's just too simple. Now, part of it, I think, is just based on a misunderstanding of the theoretical models. You seem to think, but correct me if that is a misunderstanding of a misunderstanding, you seem to think that all these adaptive speciation models or all models of evolutionary branching are based on these continuum assumptions. And that is just so wrong. I mean, first of all, I think there is about 100 published models nowadays of evolutionary branching. And probably about, I don't know, 10 or 20 of these are dealing with this Rosenzweig, MacArthur, Levins model of continuous resource exploitation. But I think partly because of the speciation applications of this, and partly because of some specific publications, that took center stage, and people tend to ignore that there are just so many other models which don't have comparable features. And here I would like to highlight especially the work of Eva Kisti and Stefan Geritz, who have worked very consistently on a completely different model, the Levins model of soft selection. And there you have exactly what you are saying we should have, and therefore indeed do have, namely fixed resources, well, not fixed, but given types of resources. You can interpret them as habitats, as environments, as resources, as I said. Actually doesn't matter in this Levins model. And all you have is that specialists can evolve that are good at either, or generalists could evolve that is good at both. You have a bit of mixing. You can tune the mixing and so on. And in these models, we also have evolutionary branching. Yeah. So it's by no means a concept or an application restricted to continuum resource distributions. On the psychological science or the kind of scientosociological level, one also has to keep in mind that I've experienced this when I study a model in which the two niches or a couple of niches are relatively well visible from the beginning, like in the Levins model. And then you come out and say, hey, we show that these two niches are colonized and we have speciation. Then reviewers go, oh, well, I mean, thank you very much. That is kind of obvious. And why do we need any mathematics to show us that these niches can be colonized? So I think psychologically there's a drive to work with these continuum models as a kind of worst case scenario. Yeah, you don't have more than one niche in these unimodal resource distributions. And yet you can get two or three or more niches emerging. So again, don't get fooled by this particular case because there are so many others. And finally, when it comes to the regulation of populations through frequency-dependent selection, I think what people often overlook is that coexistence or stable coexistence in its essence depends on frequency-dependent selection. So if somewhere in your theoretical building that you feel comfortable with, you want to talk about stable coexistence, you are in effect talking about trait-dependent frequency-dependent selection. And you might not call it like that, or you might not emphasize that angle, but that's just what it is. Now, in practical terms, I think there are two consequences. First, often these very heterogeneous resource distributions, or actually whether it's resource in terms of food or something else doesn't matter so much, but highly peaked externally given resource distributions can, of course, obstruct evolutionary branching. Yeah, as you were saying in Joel's model, they were freely evolving, and maybe they couldn't evolve because they would have to evolve through a fitness valley, and that just wouldn't happen. So the obstructive nature of these heterogeneities, I think, deserves to be recognized more. But, and then to end on a positive point, even within these given niches, you can have diversification. And for that, again, you need the kind of formalism that is very much developed for continuous resource distributions.
What we're going to do quickly here is we have a gentleman here. We've got two colleagues who want to speak. But then I think, if it's okay, I'm going to hand this back to Andy as our wonderful sort of conceptual empiricist, and Jürgen as our wonderful conceptual theoretician to get a few comments, and then we'll roll back on with people's comments. Thanks.
Yeah, thank you. So I was also going to defend the honor of adaptive dynamics, but Ulf did this already quite nicely, so I'm skipping this point. I have a second point, and this concerns this feeling that I've heard from not only from Jünger but from some empiricists that the models that we're talking about are somehow oversimplified and lack important realism and complexities that should be there. And I want to comment on this because I have for the last 2 years now or so actually tried to work with empiricists to build such a model that is somehow more parameterized from real data and contains all these complexities that people tell us to stuff in. And I mean, I want to offer the perspective from the other side. So the problem is, of course, the first thing is they want us to stuff in a lot of things that we maybe think are not so necessary, but they claim is crucially important in the system. And of course, so we do that. But this introduces a large number of parameters, of course, that you wouldn't otherwise have. This introduces certain functional shapes that you wouldn't otherwise have. And then the question is, how do you pick these functions? How do you parameterize? How do you pick these parameters? And there you would rely on empirical data to do this. And then it turns out it's often, well, especially in this case I'm thinking about now, very, very difficult to get data that is really reliable. So people have these gut feelings about, you know, they are more in the sun and in the shade, but if you ask, okay, what can you give me a probability distribution to be here or there, to say, well, it's more than that. This is linear or is this quadratic or what kind of function would you suggest that we put in there? Then it becomes very, very difficult. So, and I think this is the basic problem we are having. So we would throw this ball back and ask empiricists to provide good quantitative data about everything that they want to us to put in the models, and then we are happy to put it in. Thank you.
Okay, you heard it. Now, I'd like to caution everybody, when you say they, please just say my colleagues who do, you know, just so we can, I'm enjoying this kind of repartee back and forth, but they're not them. Yeah, and so please, we're not us and them.
A couple of the speakers spoke to sort of organismal biology, like physiology and so forth. And there is a very deep organismal biology puzzle, I think, that's relevant here. What if in one clutch of Darwin's finches you could find big birds and small beak birds and mid-sized birds, so that the polymorphism in trophic ecology is represented within a lineage? Just as in adaptive dynamics, instead of imagining that each type bred true, that you know, they flipped a coin and there was a certain probability that you produce phenotype A or phenotype B, and over time those phenotypes could drift apart, but still it's one lineage that's doing it. Well, and we know there are examples of that. You think of, evolution to dispersal, where there are these beautiful cases where there's a polymorphism of winged grasshoppers and wingless grasshoppers all in one clutch. There are some trophic polymorphisms out there. I think there's a really important problem there, because you could have phenotypic diversity, even with lots of peaks in the phenotypes matching discrete resources and so forth, without necessarily having diversity in lineages, diversity in species, however defined. I think that's a really important problem.
Well, actually, what we're going to do, we have kind of a cool trip coming up and whatnot. I'm going to let Andy have just a bit here. I'm going to let Jürgen have a bit. And then our other sort of fearless leader, she deserves a chance to have the last word on that. Liz will wrap up this one for us.
Obviously, all these are great points. And I guess I first want to comment on what Ulf was saying, and that's the psychological issue of theoreticians going at the interesting problem. But I also think that that's a mistake, really, because it's only a theoretically interesting problem. And I think that Ulf and also Bob mentioned two things that could be very interesting theoretical problems that would integrate some of these ideas. So the question is, what are the different things that will most promote diversification, and what are the different ways in which organisms might respond? And let's explore the realm of possibility that would lead us into those different outcomes. What are the factors that would promote that? What are the factors that would promote branching? How much is that driven by competition? How much is it driven by alternative resource peaks? So I think that these are really the fundamental interesting questions. And if you're worried about your papers getting accepted, I suggest that you suggest reviewers who are empiricists. Okay, not because they can't understand the math, simply because this is the interesting empirical question. Not whether you have, you know, infinite niche packing along the thing. That's not interesting at all. That's only interesting in theory. But if we're trying to explain the biological diversity, and Ulf gave a talk of, you know, biological diversity up there and had all these different organisms, that's what we're trying to explain, right? I mean, the math is interesting, and I had great fun listening to the first set of arguments, but it's not the fundamental thing we're trying to explain. And so we can make really interesting questions about what we're trying to explain that will address these different things. And then my final point, by the way, I agree on the trade-off thing, and Darwin finches do show trade-offs, and I think that's a key thing, was simply that I think these fortis are at a branching point. Okay, I mean, they're basically right at that point where they're just trying to split. So the question is, what's driving that? Now, what I need you guys to tell me is what specifically I can go in there to measure to distinguish between these different causal mechanisms for that, how that's happening. Because we can potentially do that, and we do have a place where they're in the process of splitting, and another one where they're seemingly having trouble splitting. So we could potentially, if you have money to go along with your request, do that.
Andrew, that's cool. And Andrew, thank you. And of course, we now will know if, Andrew, suddenly you have a huge number of papers to review. We'll be filling out special cards for reviewer requests on this particular topic. So, Jürgen, please.
Thank you. Well, first of all, Andrew, I will go with you to the Galapagos anytime. No problem. Yeah. So, and that would also answer another question that actually, yes, I think it would be possible to do what I asked before, that to actually somehow empirically show the presence of a branching point, although you need to make sure that you do it right somehow to make it adequate. Then also I agree that there is a lack of information, exchange of information between empiricists and theorists, that we need to meet more like here and discuss things and go to nice excursions and discuss on the bus and whatever what should be done, or go to the Galapagos perhaps. That would be nice. I had another point, but I almost lost it. No, apart from that, I think I agree with most things that have been said already. Yeah, thanks.
So we need a prospects meeting, one of the later ones, in Galapagos. They have conference facilities. It just depends on how much money, you know, prospects, other people can come up.
Ulf, how rich is your institution and thing feeling like there? But on a less expensive note, okay, all of you that really feel empirical at heart, buy a bottle of wine, find your favorite theoretician here, and sit down and talk, and vice versa. Actually, Liz, we're going to get to you in just a moment. We have somebody here that wanted to give a comment.
Well, as a wish from a theoretician to the empiricist, I would say in all models where branching can happen, whether branching happens or not, ultimately comes down to a question about trade-off curvature. So this would be really very, very important. But I'm afraid that will be very, very difficult. But I think that's an essential part to understand whether we get speciation or not.
Cool, excellent. And then to wrap up and then seamlessly move into how the other events go, Liz, please.
Okay, I didn't want to do this, but we shall continue the discussion tomorrow, and I shall be glad to get suggestions from you into which direction. While I completely understand Andrew's problem with these very theoretical questions, still, I think that you are very much interested in that which traits which will lead to speciation, how big differences between these traits are required, whether these matter or not matter, or doesn't matter, and the similar, rather practical questions which just arises when you work with your own material. So this is one remark. The other remark is concerns competition, because competition is something which is interpreted within ecology in various ways, and as far as I see, also outside ecology. But please have in mind that if you have the Lotka-Volterra model, you can just tell the whole thing in the language of frequency-dependent selection, just asking the question what is the condition for the rare type to invade. So these are different languages, and somehow these different languages should understand each other, and somehow I very often feel that most of the problems are linguistic in a way, that just we have different things in mind. So please, while we are going to the excursion, just raise topics, and we shall structure for tomorrow and then go on accordingly. Thank you.
Well, thank you very much. Can everybody give a hand to Andrew and Jürgen for being our sacrificial lambs? And I think we have an excursion coming up. And what time do we meet?
We have first coffee outside.
Oh, wonderful.
And then...
I couldn't hear.
Then for the excursion, we have to be down in front of the hotel at 4 past 4.
Yes.
Coffee now. Be in the lobby for the excursion. 4:15.
With the tickets.
With your tickets. Bring your tickets.